This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. All week long, we've been talking about The Interview, capital I, The Interview, Meghan Markle and Prince Harry sitting down with Oprah Winfrey. That interview turned out to be something maybe weightier than we had any reason to expect, and we're still talking about it today. Because this drama in the House of Windsor grappled with everything from mental health issues to racism to the most enduring institution in the United Kingdom. So I called up two wonderful writers who have engaged with these questions to talk about it. The historian Simon Schammel, who will join us in a moment, and staff writer Doreen St. Felix. Doreen, so I've got to admit that we were texting a little bit during that interview. And I thought the headline was going to be, you know, Kate made me cry or something like that. I had no idea that this interview was going to be as dramatic and in some way as important as it turned out to be. What were you expecting and what did we get?
I mean, I think we all had in our mind the very infamous interview that Princess Diana did with Martin Bashir, I think maybe 26 years ago, which was certainly an airing of grievances, but it was still wrapped up in the sense that, you know, Diana couldn't say everything that was on her mind, possibly. And I think for me, what was the most striking part of the interview was not even so much Markle's revelations. You know, as a Black woman in America, I wasn't really surprised to hear the treatment that she described. I think it was more so Harry, because Harry, we were watching, you know, he was so protective of his wife. He had his hand on her hand for the entirety of the interview. And he seemed like he was in a kind of personal crisis. He wasn't as open as Markle, but in some ways that made him all the more revealing. You know, there were answers that he didn't want to necessarily provide to Oprah. And I think his hesitancy kind of showed for the viewer how deeply conditioned he had been, you know, by not only his family as a family, but also his family as a seat of power.
Did you tell other people in the family, I need to get help for her, we need help for her?
That's just not a conversation that would be had.
Why?
I guess I was ashamed of admitting it to them.
Oh.
And I don't know whether they've had the same, whether they've had the same feelings or thoughts. I have no idea. It's a very trapping environment that a lot of them are stuck in.
You were ashamed of admitting that Meghan needed help.
Yeah.
Talk to me about Oprah as an interviewer. You know, it's been years since she's had an event like this. And I have to say, in some ways, I had been associating her with much more disappointing fare in recent years. You know, the kind of the Dr. Oz and the other quacks that she probably has invested too much in. This was something quite different. What are her qualities and what did you think of that performance?
Right. So I think it's amazing to me that in a conversation that, you know, possibly has drained the royal family of its last dredges of cultural esteem, it's Oprah that everyone's talking about. And I think there's a couple of elements to that reaction. The first being we're being brought back to the Oprah of the late 80s and the early 90s. It wasn't the Oprah of the past 20 years, the Oprah who has a massive deal with Apple, the Oprah who has become, you know, completely enmeshed with political institutions like the Obamas. It was the Oprah of the 90s, the Oprah that we, you know, rushed home after school or after work to watch on her talk show. There's that really telling moment where Meghan, you know, it happens twice, actually, if we want to talk about Oprah underlining the headline, where Meghan describes someone in the family possibly commenting on the potential skin color of her unborn child, who is now Archie.
Hold up. There's several right now. There are several conversations.
There's a conversation with you.
With Harry.
About how dark your baby is going to be?
Potentially, and what that would mean or look like.
Ooh.
And Oprah, we know her history. Oprah is not surprised to hear that Markle underwent, you know, a racist incident like that during her tenure at the family. But when Oprah reacts in that way, when she gasps, when she stops her from talking, when she acts, you know, completely surprised, what she is doing is teaching the viewer, teaching the audience that that is the appropriate reaction to have to a revelation like that, right? And it's something that's like in deep contrast with what you might see on ITV, which is that infamous British gossip channel. And so I think in that way, Oprah has done something really critical for Meghan and Harry. She's taken them out of the idiom of British gossip news and brought them into the American sort of empathetic tabloid space.
Really well said, it because it's amazing the difference in reaction to this interview in Britain and the United States. I mean,
absolutely.
You got a lot of reaction also among American conservatives that was very much like some of the tabloids in Britain, extremely disdainful of Meghan, thinking she's overly sensitive at best and making things up and all the rest. It's become a kind of, yet again, a political flashpoint in the culture wars in the United States.
Exactly. I think of someone like Megyn Kelly sort of calling out Oprah and saying that she didn't ask tough enough questions. What that really means is that Oprah is asking a different kind of tough question, you know, one that marks, I would say, a real changing in our appetites, our tolerance for what we want to see on American TV. I think that the era of the shock jock has long been gone. And, you know, in the future, we will look to this interview as a real touchstone, marking the change of like who it is that we see as authorities of their own experience. I think Oprah created a space where there was no question of doubting what Meghan or Harry were talking about. And that's not something that has always been endemic to that kind of primetime interview.
Tucker Carlson, who is probably the most vociferous voice now on Fox News, along with Sean Hannity, was utterly contemptuous of Meghan and mocked her and said that, you know, she was treating dress colors as her 9/11 and that she was faking her victimhood. Above all, that was the theme. And faking victimhood is a theme on Fox News all the time, that victimhood or people being the objects of oppression or aggression are somehow faking it, somehow too soft, that people ought to just let things go.
Right. And I don't know if I'm actually just too optimistic. I think the rote, the way that Fox News has been applying the same four or five virulent criticisms on increasingly sophisticated cultural conversations, it's just getting kind of old. And ultimately, this is about entertainment, right? This is about who can grab the audience first. And we look at the numbers. I think I read that Oprah was able to bring 50 million viewers to the interview. And I don't think that 50 million people watched Tucker Carlson that night.
No, probably not. But he does have a sizable nightly audience. And it is interesting
Absolutely. To
see that the right is using these culture war and easily grasped moments much more than traditional policy questions, you know, Dr. Seuss or what happens at Smith College or this interview, far more than, I don't know, you know, higher or lower taxes or foreign policy or whatever. These are front and center for the right.
Right. And I think what we're also sort of seeing is how does the Trump culture vacuum get filled? But I think what is more interesting to me, at least, is that an interview like Meghan Markle's is going to persuade people who are more moderate in the center, who maybe felt strange about the increasingly open ways we talk about crises like mental health and race. I think there was just like fundamental relatability. And I saw the sorts of people who don't usually get caught up in pop cultural events becoming really swept up in concern and compassion for Meghan and Harry and their plight.
But for the family, they very much have this mentality of, this is just how it is. This is how it's meant to be. You can't change it. We've all been through it.
We've all been through the pressure. We've all been through being
Yes, but what was different
exploited.
For me, what was different for me was the race element, because now it wasn't just about her, but it was about what she represents. And therefore, it wasn't just affecting my wife. It was affecting so many other people as well.
Simon Sharma is a British-born scholar who teaches at Columbia, and he's written on everything from the French Revolution to the history of the Jewish people. He's also the author of a 3-volume history of Great Britain, and someone I'm very happy to call a friend.
So, yeah, what a mish of gas, boy.
Simon, you've been living here for half of forever, but British history is in your heart. You've written about it extensively. What did this interview mean, if anything?
Well, I think it's all really about British identity crisis, David, really. I mean, it won't have escaped your attention that both in the great kind of Brexit furor and with everything else that's happened since, particularly the possibility of the United Kingdom not being so united anymore and actually threatened by the possibility of a referendum on Scottish independence, there is a kind of national neurosis going on. And usually this is being calmed by the above politics presence of the monarchy. But the monarchy is kind of stuck right now because it's trying to do at least two sets of very contradictory things. On the one hand, in order to pacify a national identity crisis, it's got to be timeless. But particularly for the younger generation of people living in Britain, it's also got to be of our times, especially since Black Lives Matter. You know, a lot of attention paid across the Atlantic, and also Black Lives Matter does matter in Britain itself.
Well, what will this interview do, though, to shake the foundations of the monarchy? How can you predict that?
It's generational, I think, as is so much of life these days, you know, politics as well. There have already been opinion polls, you won't be surprised to hear, and it's shown a majority, if they can be trusted, you know, instant polls, who knows. But if they can be trusted, they've shown that the interview has the opposite effect to what it seems to have had in this country. It's not gone down terribly well. But it's the older generation, of course, actually, the 94-year-old Queen, those who have the most deeply longing, nostalgic instincts for what Britain's supposed to be, who are comforted by the spectacle of the Queen up there on her horse at the Trooping of the Colour, who are touched by Prince Philip being in hospital at the age of 99, all of that. The younger generation, much, much more exercised by the issue of race, by the whole notion of, you know, is the United Kingdom essentially a white United Kingdom or something else? And, I mean, the verdict really is out, because those who've defended the monarchy in this particular furor, I mean, are right to note that when Meghan was married to Harry, there was an enormous, you know, they were welcomed, as Meghan herself said, with open arms by the Queen, but by the country at large. If you remember the wedding, there was an American black preacher, there was the, you know, the black family and so on. And there was a sort of, much in the spirit of the kind of Britain of the opening of the Olympic Games in 2012, it seemed to be a real embrace of a multicultural, multiracial Britain. And, you know, this has been a kind of brutal counterpush, a brutal shock in the opposite direction.
the conversation about racism, about anti-blackness in Britain plays out quite differently than it does in the United States. Tell me how that works.
It's getting to be less of a gap, as a matter of fact, I have to say. The British like to pat themselves on the head or on the back or wherever by saying, well, we actually abolished slavery in 1834. It took a civil war for America to do this. We were one of the first countries to abolish the slave trade, in fact, only 1 year ahead of Jefferson's America. But there was a sort of sense of possibly disingenuous self-congratulation about, you know, the place of race that could be absorbed sponge-like into British life. That's proving really to have feet of clay, that sort of notion really of an instinctively tolerant, inclusive Britain. These days, whether it's a discussion about so-called decolonizing of the museums, a discussion about how some of the great antiquities in the British Museum arrived as a result, basically, of imperial plunder, that's a conversation which is becoming profound now. And the sense that we all ought to be tremendously smug about early abolitionism only seems to rub salt in that particular wound. So I would say that Britain is becoming, in matters of race, a more self-scrutinizing and angrier country in ways in which we would recognize here in the United States.
Angrier in the sense of more polarized?
Yeah, I think so.
I guess it's amazing that an Oprah Winfrey interview with a former minor television star who becomes royalty and someone who's not really very directly in the line of succession, Harry, has such resonance. Simon, would you be sorry to see the monarchy go?
Yes, I would, which may surprise you. But then, of course, I'm an old geezer. Worse, I'm an old geezer historian. And therefore I'm into antiquity, right? you look around the world and think, well, what's the alternative? If Britons really want to see what the alternative might be, you know, they look across the Atlantic and see what politics has been like at the court of King Donald I. And they're much reassured, really, by the fact that that's not the case in Britain.
Simon Sharma, thank you, my friend. It's good to talk to you.
Okay, my dear. Lovely to talk to you. Stay safe.
All the best. Simon Sharma is a professor at Columbia University, and he's the author of more than a dozen works of history. Doreen St. Felix is a staff writer at The New Yorker, and you can find her work at newyorker.com. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Evan Osnos is a staff writer based in Washington, and he recently covered the endless presidential campaign. And for many years, Evan was based in China. He was the New Yorker's correspondent in Beijing, and he still writes for us about China and Xi Jinping's regime. That made Evan particularly interested in a new book called 2034. It's a work of fiction, a thriller in which an incident between the American and Chinese navies balloons into a catastrophe. Here's Evan.
The U.S. and China are the world's two superpowers, and their relationship has deteriorated quite sharply over the course of the last few years across a whole range of issues around technology and trade and defense and espionage. And whether or not you think one side is right or wrong, the reality is that the stakes are very, very high. One of the big places where that tension is playing out day to day in ways that Americans frankly don't really see very much is in the South China Sea.
China claims almost the entire area and for years has been militarizing the islands, constructing remote outposts.
It's a vast piece of the ocean that China claims as its own territory, rich with petroleum and minerals under the sea floor. But other nations, including the United States, contest that claim.
A U.S. aircraft carrier group entered the South China Sea. The group, led by the USS Theodore Roosevelt, will conduct routine operations to ensure freedom of the seas, build partnerships...
Admiral James Stavridis is one of the authors of the book 2034, and he's maybe not somebody you'd expect to be writing a gripping novel. Stavridis is a retired four-star naval officer. He worked as the Supreme Allied Commander at NATO. Admiral, how much of what's in this book draws on your own life experience?
The other day, Evan, I went back and added up all the days I've spent at sea on the deep ocean, out of sight at land. It's about 9.5 years when you add it all up. So this is my provenance, if you will. And certainly the opening scene of the book on the destroyer where the Commodore, who is in command of these three destroyers, is cutting a big wake, as we would say, drawing a big ocean through the South China Sea. That's quite real. I've done exactly that.
Elliot Ackerman co-wrote the novel. He's a journalist, a novelist, and he was a Marine in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, these freedom of navigation patrols are something that the U.S. Navy actively does through the South China Sea, where there is, you know, a bit of a dispute whether or not those are or not international waters. So we fly the flag down there. But, you know, in the book, the way we describe it specifically is it's the equivalent of, you know, driving donuts in your neighbor's yard if they move the fence a little bit too close to you. So it's sort of one of these, you know, very, you know, aggressive actions, you know, in its way, depending on what side of the freedom of navigation patrol you're on. And, you know, at the outset with the book, you know, that was going to be the precipitating incident, something that happens on one of these freedom of navigation patrols.
I will tell you, it's a pretty realistic opening scene right up to the moment when the ships get torpedoed and go to the bottom of the ocean. Let's hope that doesn't come true.
I want to be very clear. This is a work of speculative fiction. It's not real. But for anybody who follows these issues, it's a bit of creepy reading because it's based in the very real tensions between these two countries. I'm curious about how it was that you decided to take a subject as complex, as rich as the South China Sea. Frankly, it's the kind of thing that you see written about in reports in Washington and testimony at the Pentagon. And you decided that this actually should exist as a novel. Elliot, how did this happen?
Well, it was an idea that was originally Jim's. So, you know, he had had this idea of, you know, what if we could contribute to what in the past had been often speculative fiction around things like the Third World War. And it was sort of a genre that we hadn't seen a contribution to for a while. And so the idea of, you know, what if we were to write a speculative novel about what it looked like if the U.S. and China went to war. So he approached his book editor, Scott liked the idea, said, you know, it would be great if you teamed up with a novelist on this. And oh, by the way, aren't you and Elliot friends? And it just felt like a very, very natural fit. So I was, you know, very enthusiastic about the project. We sat down, we said, let's see if we can write the first chapter, which is very much the chapter that's in the book right now. And we did. And it was a really fun collaboration. And I say the book is fun. I mean, we very much had the goal of wanting to make a readable, character-driven novel. Because, again, another point, you know, we were very aligned on in creating this character, these characters, where the villain in the book is war. This is the characters are coming at this conflict from a variety of point of views. All of them we aspire to tell sympathetically.
Let me just add to that, if I can. What I had in mind when I initially came up with the idea, it was films like Dr. Strangelove, books like The Bedford Incident, The Third World War by Sir John Hackett. These are not so much, in my view, speculative fiction as cautionary fiction. Think On the Beach by Neville Shute. And I think that part of the reason we avoided destroying the world in a Cold War was that we imagined our way to how terrible it could become. And that was something Elliot and I both agree on, I know, is that we're pretty good at intelligence. We need to get better at imagining. If we could have imagined the World Trade Towers going down, if we could have imagined a 20-year war in Afghanistan, maybe we could have reverse engineered it and killed it before it came to be true. That's kind of the fundamental point from my perspective about 2034.
Staying on that theme of imagining how things could go very wrong, one of the most chilling scenes in the book is when it becomes clear that China has developed cyber weapons that are way beyond anything the U.S. has. Could one of you read this scene? Does one of you have more high school acting experience than the other?
I think
anyone who could see this visually and see the 5'5" balding early 60s admiral or just turned 40 former skateboarding champion Elliot Ackerman is going to go for door number two. So Elliot, over to you.
Can we make sure that doesn't get cut in the final?
No, that's going in. That's going in. So, Elliot, page 39, if you will,
okay.
Please.
Right.
And just to set it up, this is a scene near the beginning of the book when the security officials in Washington are just discovering what's happening in the South China Sea. They're sort of panicking and trying to figure out how they can get the upper hand. And at that moment, they get a phone call from a Chinese official named Lin Bao.
Hello, said Chowdhury into the speaker.
Yes, I'm here,
came the otherworldly echo of Lin Bao's voice on the line. He sounded impatient, as though he were being forced to continue a conversation he'd tired of long ago.
Let me repeat your position to assure that I understand it. For decades, your Navy has sailed through our territorial waters. It has flown through our allies' airspace, and today it has seized one of our vessels. But you maintain that you are the aggrieved party, and we are the ones who must appease you?
The room became so quiet that for the first time, Chowdhury noticed the slight buzzing of the halogen light bulbs overhead. That is the position of this administration, answered Chowdhury, needing to swallow once to get the words out. However, if you have a counterproposal, we would, of course, take it into consideration. More silence. Then Lin Bao's exasperated voice.
We do have a counterproposal.
Good, injected Chowdhury, but Lin Bao ignored him, continuing on.
If you check, you'll see that it's been sent to your computer.
Then the power went out. It was only a moment, a flash of darkness. The lights immediately came back on. And when they did, Lin Bao wasn't on the line anymore. There was only an empty dial tone. You know, you could imagine as we enter this first chapter and there's this altercation in the South China Sea and it's looking like it could become increasingly kinetic, that the crescendo at the end of that chapter might be some, you know, explosive incident. But it's not. The lights just go out. The Chinese, in effect, blink the entire East Coast. And so just from a creative standpoint, it was how do we show the reader what this looks like? How do we make them feel how chilling this is?
Eliot says it exactly right. We are reaching for ways that people can understand the seriousness of the concerns here, simply because that vulnerability is explosively expanding for two very quick reasons. One is the expansion of the threat surface. 10 years ago, there were 7 billion people on the planet and 7 billion devices connected to the internet. Today, there are still roughly 7 billion people on the planet and 40 billion devices. That is an enormous threat surface. And secondly, it is China's ability to move at speed in this world. They are accelerating rapidly.
You know, the spirit of this book is, as we've said, very much the idea that imagining can become a deterrent. You know, as Jim said, we know we have plenty of intelligence, we have plenty of hardware, but what we often lack is imagination. And then also the imagination that as you enter one of these high-tech wars, you know, perhaps without giving too much away, you realize that many of your low-tech capabilities that you've allowed to atrophy actually become the essential capability that you need to win the war.
You've both described this extraordinary, what feels to me like a very fragile combination of people and events and decisions that can lead us either in the desperately wrong direction or, one hopes, in the right direction. We've talked a lot about what could go wrong in this relationship between the U.S. and China. What could go right? Help us see that path a bit.
I'd love to. And, you know, I want to say that the book is not good guy U.S., bad guy China. It's not the theme of the work here. And my own strategy for dealing with China, if I boiled it down to a couple of words, would be confront where we must, but cooperate wherever we can. We must confront China on the claims of the South China Sea. And we must confront China, my view, on gross human rights violations, for example, Uyghurs in China. We must confront on that. But there are so many places we can cooperate. One is climate. We're not going to solve the environmental challenges we have, which are immense, unless the U.S. and China can cooperate together. Second would be the pandemic. And I'm not talking about the current pandemic. I'm talking about the next pandemic. And newsflash, there will be another pandemic. And then third and finally, I would say humanitarian work, medical diplomacy. Both nations operate hospital ships. Think of the power of putting the capabilities of the U.S. and China together to do that. And that sounds perhaps to some kind of Pollyanna-ish, except 2 years ago, the U.S. Navy ship Mercy, our big, beautiful West Coast hospital ship, operated right alongside China's hospital ship. We can do this. And so confront where we must, but try and find those zones of cooperation. I think that's crucial if we're going to avoid the scenario we lay out in 2034.
Thank you to you both, Admiral James DeVries, Eliot Ackerman. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Evan.
You can read Evan Osnos's work on politics, China, and many other subjects on NewYorker.com. He spoke with retired Admiral James Stavridis and Eliot Ackerman. Their new book is called 2034. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
So if you look at the way trans stories show up in mainstream media, you start to notice that the narratives fall into certain categories. Trans writers sometimes complain that the easiest way to get a book deal or sell a memoir is to tell a story about your journey of self-empowerment or your feel-good coming out story or your struggle with the trauma of being trans. Detransition Baby is different from that.
Detransition Baby. It's a new novel that's been featured in O Magazine. It's on Roxane Gay's book club list, and it's being adapted for television. Part of the talk about the book is that Tori Peters' novel represents something really new. One of the very first novels by a trans woman put out by a major publishing house, in this case, Penguin Random House. Crispin Long wrote for The New Yorker about Tori Peters and Detransition Baby. And here's Crispin.
The characters are not always self-empowered. They don't always make good choices. They can be mean. They can be catty. They can be sloppy. It's a dishy, gossipy kind of novel. It reads almost like a soap opera, a very complicated soap opera.
Detransition Baby is the story of three characters. Can I start over again? This is like, my own book is confusing.
It's not super easy to summarize.
I'll say it. You don't have to. I did a bad job.
It's really hard to summarize. It took me like forever to write the paragraph that just like describes what the book is about.
All right. This is good that this is not live.
Totally understand.
Okay. So it's the story of three characters, Ames, Reese, and Katrina. It starts with Reese, who's a trans woman. And you can think of her as sort of Fleabag, but trans and in Brooklyn. Her life's a little bit of a mess. She's sleeping with married men. She's not sure about her job. And she's always wanted a baby. Her ex-girlfriend, Amy, who detransitioned to become Ames, is sleeping with his boss, Katrina, and gets Katrina pregnant. Knowing that Reese has always wanted a baby, Ames comes back to Reese and proposes that they all raise the family together.
Yeah, that was good. So how did you come up with the idea for how these three people would maybe fit together or relate to each other? Like, how did their relationships sort of start to take shape in your mind?
A lot of it was that I was looking for ways to ask questions that were bothering me in my 30s as a trans woman. And I was looking for models of basically how to find meaning. The book starts out with something I call the Sex and the City problem, which is the models that looked available to me were embodied sort of by the Sex and the City characters. You can have a baby, you can have a career, you can get married, or you can kind of find meaning through art. But the problem is that for trans women, there's a way in which these solutions are still a little bit aspirational. So, and the most difficult, I think, for trans women right now is motherhood. I don't know very many trans women who have children who didn't have children before they transitioned. So I wanted to go right at this baby question. And then the other questions that were sort of troubling me in my 30s began to like work their way in through other characters. So ideas of divorce, ideas of the temptation to detransition. And after that, it was just a simple question of, you know, classic protagonist-antagonist situation where there's one baby and three different people who have all sorts of different ideas about it and everybody can't get what they want.
Yeah. I thought the title was incredibly clever. It's sort of cheekily literal because we have a person who detransitioned, you know, someone who transitioned and decided to revert back to living as the gender they were assigned at birth. And then we have the prospect of like an actual literal baby. Why is detransition such a complicated subject in trans communities?
I think that detransition has been weaponized. And it's been weaponized in a particular way where people say that, oh, you detransitioned because you were wrong about being trans. And you sort of give evidence to this idea that basically trans people shouldn't exist, that it's a mental illness, or that it's, you know, in some ways. So it's a very loaded thing. The reality is that amongst trans people, I think most trans people I know detransitioners. I know detransitioners. And the reasons that they detransition tend to be less about the ways that it gets talked about publicly or gets weaponized, but they detransition because life was just really hard as a trans woman or a trans guy. And the reality is that oftentimes there are regrets, right? But the regrets aren't like, oh, I wasn't trans. The regrets are like, my family doesn't talk to me anymore. I can't make any money. You know, I have regrets. And the other thing is that, like, I also just want to own detransition as a trans woman. Instead of letting it be weaponized, you know, by anti-trans sort of activists, I was kind of like, I'm going to own it. I'm going to talk about it how trans people talk about it amongst ourselves.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's funny. There's kind of a fixation on, like, you know, trans suffering. And I think kind of shedding light on this version of detransition, it just makes it more specific. Like, the suffering is related to people's reaction to it. It's not intrinsic to the experience of being trans. So the book moves back and forth in time. And there are scenes where we see Ames in the past when he was living as a trans woman and going by Amy. And in one of these scenes, Amy, she's at a queer dance party with some other trans women and Reese. And they encounter someone named William, an old acquaintance of Amy's friends who has also detransitioned. And Amy strikes up a conversation with him. So could you read the passage where she interacts with William?
Yeah. William was quite drunk, too drunk to speak in grammatical sentences, but his face lit up at her attention in a way that hurt Amy to examine directly. She watched his cigarette instead of his face, tried not to notice the soft and pupil quality to his body. Here's what Amy got from the conversation. He'd lived as a trans woman for 7 years, but it was too hard, too hard. He didn't pass. He wanted to die. He was still a trans woman. Everybody saw it, no matter what he did, but since he wouldn't say so, they couldn't either. He had a good job now, medical supply distribution. He lived on Staten Island with those two young girls. He drove them to the party tonight and helped them get dressed. He didn't touch them, don't worry. He just liked being one of the girls. The cigarette looped in his hands, inscribing arcs of red in the night as he talked. Amy focused on the tip as if it were writing secret messages just for her. The more he spoke, the more Amy understood the polite, unsettling disdain the other trans woman had shown him. She wanted to be anywhere but standing there listening to him. Pity teetered on the precipice of disgust. When Amy detransitioned herself, she promised never to let anyone see her as she had seen William that night. Never to pant for inclusion from trans women. Ames wanted no pity and rejected their disgust. But despite Ames's rigid need for dignity, for all the careful lines he drew to respect the differences in how he lived and how trans women lived, they called to him in a siren song.
So you also get a sense in the scene of Ames's kind of strong longing to be part of this group again. And like, there's something kind of intractable about his transness. So what makes it worth it to him, do you think, to detransition?
I mean, I don't know. Like, I know as an author why I think, and part of it is extrapolating from my own kind of yearnings. Occasionally I've had like times in my life where things have been really hard, and I've wanted to detransition. There was a time about 3 years after transition where, you know, I'd been divorced. I couldn't get work. I was like living in a strange roommate situation. And I was like, how did my life end up this way where I'm estranged from all these people I cared about? And so the reasons I wanted to detransition were were basically like, if I could just figure out how to live as a guy, maybe I could get that stuff back. And then eventually I was like, no, actually that stuff is gone. And you know, it's time to move on. And I think that Ames's reasons for detransitioning are somewhat similar, that like it just got to be too much. The other thing I think that I was trying to do here is that in a lot of ways, transition narratives are really overly determined. Like we've seen, like I think a lot of people have seen enough transition like memoirs or narratives or stories that we have like an arc of what a transition should look like. For me, what was interesting was that detransition is actually that same arc in reverse. And so it's like, you know, suddenly it's trans people who were, you know, resentful that this person has abandoned their gender and things like that. And so it was a way to kind of explore in ways that aren't so overdetermined a lot of the feelings that people have around transition. You know, detransition was a way to take it out of that kind of like context where like you're supposed to be like, oh, I support anybody who transitions. Whereas like detransition, no, there's no narrative about supporting detransitioners. So you could actually talk about this stuff in like a new way. So when I think about Ames's yearning to be around trans women after he detransitioned, a lot of that was me thinking about before I transitioned, my yearning to be around trans women. And then after I transitioned, somebody gets confusing when I talk about it this way. After I transitioned, my yearning to then be around like my old friends. So detransition was a way to, was like a key into talking about transition in a way where everybody didn't feel like they already knew the narrative.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm also curious about sort of the previous era of writing you did when you were involved with Topside Press, the literary scene of trans writers. Could you tell me a little bit about Topside? What was it trying to do and how did you get involved?
Sure. So the Topside era, I guess you could say, was around 2012 to maybe 2015. Topside Press was run by Riley McLeod and Tom Legere, and they published a couple of books by trans women that became quite well known in sort of a scene. It was Imogen Binney's Nevada, Casey Plett's A Safe Girl to Love, and Sybil Lamb's I've Got a Time Bomb. But basically the idea of it was that it was this writing for other trans people kind of scene. We thought it would be sort of like the Harlem Renaissance or Paris in the 20s. If you picture sort of like cubism, where it was like a bunch of people coming together and like riffing on each other's ideas, that's how like the art in that era accelerated. And we hoped that something similar would happen and trans writing would sort of take off as a consequence. Unfortunately, it sort of imploded during the era in the way that like a lot of art scenes implode, especially where people are poor, or there's scarcity, or you know, they're doing sex work, or they're you know, there's drinking or whatever. There also, the problem was that there was really only Topside, this press run by these two guys, these two trans guys. That was like the only game in town. And so when I started self-publishing, it was in reaction to what happened with Topside, that I had this vision that what if I started self-publishing and I taught all these other trans women or trans people how to self-publish, then there wouldn't be as much scarcity around publishing. So, and I chose the novella as my form because I was like, well, I can't expect these people who have such instability in their life to be writing novels. It takes 3 years, but you can write a novella in 3 months. I talked about very taboo subjects. The Masker was the first, and it talked about sort of sissy fetishists in trans community, which was always like sort of a thing that you shouldn't talk about. And the second one was Infect Your Friends and Loved Ones, which had a lot to do with like sort of trans separatism and trans anger, which also was a somewhat taboo subject. So they ended up getting passed around, and as a consequence, they became sort of these a little bit like, they had like sort of cult status that they were passed around Brooklyn, which is how, in the end, when Penguin Random House was interested in my work, it was partly out of that cult status and partly also because I'd done all that work alone. I had a really strong vision for how I wanted the book to work and who I wanted to read it.
Yeah, I mean, now that you have had such a different experience with the publishing industry, Do you feel like the publishing industry has changed or is changing?
Yes. I mean, I think there's ways in which it is and ways in which it isn't. I'm a really particular type of trans woman, you know, and I wrote a book that is basically a trans version of what could otherwise be like a dishy, gossipy, women's bestseller. So I think it makes sense that they were like, well, if we're going to take a chance on a trans woman, let's take a chance on this one. So I'm curious to see what happens with the publishing industry. I'm curious what happens when the novel isn't a dishy, gossipy, you know, woman's novel. What happens when it's a novel by a Black trans woman writing about her family or her experience? You know, are people still interested? I think it's possible they might be. I mean, I just don't know.
Yeah, I'm thinking too about a profile of you in Vulture. The author, Lila Shapiro, speaks to the legendary queer writer and activist, Sarah Schulman, who's involved with Topside Press, I believe. And Schulman says something really interesting. The author asked Schulman if she thinks the trans literary world is entering a renaissance. And Schulman says, we might be leaving it. What do you think she meant by that?
I think you could read that as sort of shade, you know, where like she's saying Tori sold out. And, you know, fair. But I think actually, if you think about like the scenes that I compared it to, Paris in the 1920s, Paris in the 1920s was cool when everybody was living in Paris and was poor and was like sharing stuff. You know, there's a way in which the kind of adversity does create, it pressurizes those scenes to create incredible work. So I think there's a precedent for what Sarah's saying. Sarah isn't trans. And I would say that, you know, I think that that a lot of the people from the Topside scene were like, that scene was very painful. And I don't think like, let's recreate the privations of the Topside scene. I want my book to be successful. And I don't want poverty or lack of resources to be the reasons why these books don't get written.
Tori Peters is the author of Detransition Baby. She spoke with Crispin Long.
What's next for you? Are you working on anything new now?
I am. I'm working on a queer financial thriller. This is going to sound incredibly grandiose, but it's like Breaking Bad meets The Big Short meets, I'm going to go for it, The Great Gatsby. So that.
Yeah, I'm pulling for it.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us. See you next week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.